The leaders of the world's 20 largest economies sat down in Seoul, South Korea today for the beginning of a two-day summit, with many of their economies still struggling after the financial meltdown that began in 2008. The leaders have an ambitious agenda. Joining me now to look at what's happened in the first day of meetings is Gillian Tett, U.S. Managing Editor and an Assistant Editor for the Financial Times. I'm very pleased to welcome her to today's second Backstory segment. Hello.
Hello. Well, thank you for having me on the show.
What happened during today's talks? Are there any signs that there's been much progress or any progress?
Well, you basically had a lot of diplomatic handshaking, everyone trying to put on a jolly united front. But the reality is that thus far, at least, not very much has been achieved, other than a general agreement that people want to avoid too much confrontation in Seoul this weekend. And, you know, people prefer to try and paper over the cracks. So some of the ideas that the Americans were floating, Timothy Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, was floating a few weeks ago about, for example, trying to get some kind of current account limits agreed. You know, that has been quietly shelved because it's viewed as being simply too controversial.
Well, some of the things on the agenda, we'll be talking about currency in just a moment, but some of the other things are ensuring global economic recovery, framework for sustainable global growth, strengthening the international financial regulatory system, modernizing international financial institutions, global financial safety nets, development issues, an awful lot to achieve in 2 days. Obviously, the 2 days are really more for show, and then the real work occurs before and after.
Absolutely. I mean, there's been an awful lot of horse trading and jockeying and rows behind the scenes in recent days. And even now, there's a lot of quibbling about the final communique. And, you know, the kind of type of controversial issues won't be a surprise to anyone. On the one hand, there's an ongoing row about how to treat internationally important banks, the degree to which people should or should not be pushing up capital standards and imposing more surveillance on them. At the same time, there's also a bit of a fight going on about what to do when a bank goes bust, who should bear the burden of that, whether it's taxpayers, and if so, which taxpayers, or whether it's the investors in a bank. But the really big one that everyone is focusing on right now is very much the currency question, because on the one hand, you have the Americans trying to push the Chinese to let their currency strengthen. On the other hand, you have the Chinese and others saying, well, it's extremely unfair to be asking us to do that when you've just unleashed quantitative easing in the U.S., which is going to make the dollar weaken. And the fact you've had, you know, none other than Alan Greenspan, for example, the former chairman of the Federal Reserve, weighing into the debate and saying that, yes, the type of quantitative easing we've seen in the U.S. is going to weaken the dollar, has just inflamed passion further. I mean, again, earlier this week, Bob Zoellick, president of the World Bank, wrote in the Financial Times a fascinating piece which, you know, dared to suggest that maybe, just maybe, it's time to start looking at gold as, you know, a potential anchor for the monetary system. I mean, he wasn't calling for a gold standard. He was just floating the idea in a very general sense. And that's sort of indicative of the type of uncertainty and the kind of jostling for the position that's going on right now.
Well, the gold standard was in place before the Great Depression, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the gold standard was in place effectively until the 1960s, 70s. And, of course, you know, one of the key things is that the abolition of that essentially paved the way for untrammeled creation of credit. And the value of that credit, the value of money, was only dependent on the credibility of central banks. And one of the things that's happened in the last couple of years is the credibility of central banks is starting to be questioned more than in many years. So those are the sort of the undercurrents of fighting. But the really big question, the big thing which underscores the whole of this debate, is how the world is going to cope with the shift of power, economic power, away from America towards countries like China. And, you know, in the aftermath of the financial crisis, there was such a sense of shock and such a sense of immediacy and urgency that the leaders had to do something quickly to respond, that the G20 did manage to pull together and produce some kind of coordinated action. But it's one thing to respond quickly to an immediate shock amid a sense of panic. It's quite another to try and tackle the much longer-term structural imbalances that are now besetting the world, that, you know, for example, this China-U.S. relationship, And thus far, at least, we've seen little willingness that people are willing to try and address that. And I don't think Seoul's going to change that, unfortunately.
Have the tensions over devaluing currencies been affecting world markets?
Well, one of the things that is happening right now is that there's a lot more volatility in the markets. The foreign exchange markets in particular are pretty volatile. I mean, if you go back 3 years ago during the height of the credit crisis, what was quite surprising back there was that actually there wasn't that much volatility in the foreign exchange markets. It was the price of bonds or the price of mortgage debt that was plunging or rising, or the price of bank debt. But now this year, this really is turning into the year when foreign exchange tensions are rising quite sharply. And you've seen things, all kinds of strange moves. I mean, you know, the Ireland is in the center of a storm right now because investors are expressing growing concern about whether it might default. At the same time, you've got money rushing into places like Brazil, to name one example. South Korea is another one. India. And governments are trying to slap on forms of capital controls to prevent that. And at the same time, of course, you've got growing pressure on the Chinese to try and revalue their currency. And that is also creating jitters. So it's pretty uneasy time right now.
Germany is also a major global exporter. How have they reacted to this debate?
Well, they are sort of in an interesting position, the Germans. I mean, in general, the Germans favor a strong currency. That's a bedrock of the German political economy and how they view themselves. And having lived through the experience of hyperinflation in the interwar years, they tend to have very strong views about the need to avoid that at all costs. So the Germans tend to want a strong currency right now, and they don't want to go down the U.S. path of, say, quantitative easing.
Quantitative easing meaning pretty much printing money, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an experiment which the Federal Reserve is currently engaged with, modeled partly on what happened in Japan about a decade ago, where essentially instead of cutting interest rates continually because they get to the point when you can't cut any further, you start buying assets like government bonds or mortgage bonds to pump more money into the economy. And the net result basically is an extremely radical loosening of monetary policy. So one of the huge dividers opened up in the last few months is that the U.S. has been engaged in these radical monetary experiments, as we've seen by the $600 billion that the Federal Reserve announced recently it was going to use for quantitative easing. The Europeans have not. Now, that's largely because the Germans don't want to go down that route. They remember hyperinflation. They're very cautious. But the really interesting thing right now, and what's really causing more volatility in the Eurozone, is that there are other parts of the Eurozone which desperately need to have a weaker currency and perhaps a looser monetary policy too, such as Ireland, such as Portugal. And the kind of tensions that are emerging within the Eurozone as a result of trying to anchor disparate countries into a single monetary regime is one of the things that's simply adding fuel to this general sense of volatility and nervousness.
Well, most markets went up on the news of the $600 billion that the Federal Reserve is going to use to buy Treasury bonds. So investors around the world seem to welcome the announcement. Are they at variance with their governments?
Well, the issue really is this, that the markets went up because you're basically putting more money into the system. And right now, that money is not being used to make loans to small companies. It's not being used to make loans to households for mortgages and things like that. The banks don't want to use that money to actually have, you know, for credit purposes. So instead, an awful lot of that money is finding its way into asset markets and asset prices and basically fueling the rally in the share prices, in many other instruments as well. And, you know, in the short term, that's kind of good because it makes everyone feel happy. And yes, asset prices are going up, stock markets are rallying. You know, it creates a general feeling of bonhomie. And the Federal Reserve's big, big bet right now is the sheer act of creating that sense of happiness, of feel-good factor as investors look at the value of their rising share portfolios will in itself stimulate more economic growth. And people will say, well, hey, stock market's up, I'll go and, say, buy a new car or something. The problem, however, is that that kind of linkage is not sure, it's not certain, it's not proven. You know, people might look at the fact that stock market's gone up and say, wow, great, I'm going to pay down more debt instead of actually trying to spend more money and stimulate the economy on a household level. And the danger is that you could end up in a situation where asset prices, stock markets are being pumped artificially high. The real economy is not actually growing. And at some point further down the road, you're paving the way for a nasty correction.
Is it noteworthy that the announcement of the $600 billion in Treasury bonds was made just a week before the summit? Was the U.S. trying to send a signal to the rest of the world, do you
think?
Well,
there's a lot of conspiracy theory about that. And, you know, frankly, that is what a lot of other non-American countries would mutter right now, that the timing just looks pretty odd. Now, the Federal Reserve, for its part, insists that, you know, it is entirely independent and that it has absolutely no mandate to worry about the value of the dollar. And that if other countries have bought a lot of dollars, if the Chinese have stocked up on astonishing amounts of dollars in recent years because they've been trying to prevent the value of their currency rising, then that's their business and it's not for the Fed to worry about. And so the Fed would argue very strongly that it's more to do with the state of the American domestic recovery, in particular the unemployment issue, which is driving them. But the problem that besets the American administration right now is that's not how, say, the Chinese view it at all. I mean, they view it as a provocative gesture that's made their job a lot harder. I mean, it's not just the Chinese. I mean, for the Brazilians and the Indians, for example, you're seeing this extraordinary flow of money into their economies as the investors are sitting there saying, well, with all this free money swirling around the U.S., you know, I don't know what to do with my money. I'm going to take it out of the U.S. and put it somewhere else. So it's made a lot of other countries' job a lot harder in terms of trying to shape policy. And, of course, you know, some people see it as an attempt by the U.S. to flex its muscles and show that it's not the only player, or rather that show the Chinese that they're not the only player who have the ability to intimidate people on the world stage.
In a lunchtime address, Chancellor Angela Merkel emphasized the importance of countries not resorting to protectionist measures. Is that a growing concern? And considering the fact that Germany is the largest economy in the Eurozone, doesn't that give it a lot of sway when it comes to monetary and fiscal policy for the euro?
Well, the fact that Germany is the largest economy in the Eurozone certainly gives it an enormous amount of sway, but it doesn't give it the ability to dictate policy. It still has to get other members of the Eurozone on board. And that's one of the reasons why policymaking in the Eurozone is so slow and often quite so uncertain. And that in itself is a problem right now, because what investors in the markets are looking for are clear signs of action and clear signs of policy decisions. So just to cite one example, it's currently very unclear what would happen if a country like Ireland, say, were to go bust. The government's actually arguing about what they would do, and the Germans have one view and other countries have another. And there's unlikely to be any resolution to that for a while, and that's, again, adding to the uncertainty. But on the issue of protectionism, I mean, you can be cynical and say, actually, Angela Merkel's trying to distract attention away from the type of problems that I've just cited in terms of the cracks in the political unity of the Eurozone. But she also does put her finger on a very good point, which is that as the economic tensions around the global system rise, as all the countries, you know, scramble to do whatever they can to boost their own national economies, this is inevitably putting them into conflict with each other. And yes, there is every risk that protectionism will grow. You know, the good news, if you like, is thus far during the last 3 years, it's been remarkable the degree to which protectionism has not actually resurfaced as of yet. You know, in spite of all the squeals in America from, you know, the unions or from politicians about, you know, unfair competition, there actually haven't been that much increase in tangible protectionism. The risk, though, is that going forward, it's going to get a lot worse.
Other countries are also facing tough choices. In France, there have been widespread strikes over raising the retirement age. Yesterday in London, there were angry protests over a plan to raise university tuition. And we've seen unrest all over Europe. Are these domestic political and economic problems having an effect on the mood of the meeting in Seoul? Because we haven't had similar situations in previous G20 meetings, have we?
Well, you have had a sense of crisis in previous G20 meetings. Of course, the reason the G20 came into being as a really active forum was precisely as a result of the financial crisis and the drama around the collapse of Lehman Brothers and things like that. But the big issue to understand is that when the G20 was meeting in London, you know, 18 months ago, in reaction to what was the financial crisis, everybody was scared of the same thing. Everyone was worried about how to contain the financial crisis and stop it spreading. And everyone was concerned about how to rein the banks in. So there was a sense of unity of purpose. Right now, every single government knows that it's facing an increasingly angry electorate or voters or an increasingly angry population for those who don't live in democracies. And whether it's the Chinese, who are very worried indeed that if they were to increase the value of their currency, exports would fall and they'd have a large proportion of unemployed people in China that could cause unrest, or whether it's the Americans who are sitting there saying, well, if we don't get growth somehow, we will have a, increasingly angry population ourselves.
Jillian, we have to leave it there, unfortunately. Thank you so much. Jillian Tett, U.S. Managing Editor and Assistant Editor for the Financial Times. We've been talking about the G20 summit in Seoul, South Korea, as part of our Backstory series. Thanks again.
Thank you.